Greg Braden, author and lecturer and the guy who has been a regular guest here on Coast to Coast for many years. Thank you for joining us on Coast to Coast Live, Greg.
Good evening. It's a pleasure to hear your voice, and it's really great to be back on the program this evening. Thank you.
I think the last time we spoke was when you were coming into the Twin Cities, and you were still touring on the God Code.
That's correct. And it was much later in the evening. This is probably the earliest show we've ever done on a Saturday night.
So here's the question. I mean, first of all, before we get to the secret of the lost mode of prayer, I still keep the Isaiah effect by my bedstand. I find that a very enjoyable book just to kind of pick up and put down again. And I guess as I was reading through some of the material for tonight's show, I still wonder, what do you hear back from people about the God Code or the Isaiah effect? Do you get sort of updated material or reactions to that stuff that you put out to the universe so many years ago?
Well, sure, we do, Ian. And first, thank you for enjoying our work so much.
That's cool.
It is part of an ongoing research project. All of these books, as different as they may sound from one another in their content, they're all part of an ongoing research project that that led me from my careers that you mentioned earlier in the aerospace and defense industries to understand our relationship with the forces of our world, of the universes, of nature, and to understand the information in our culture that was lost to the West almost 1,700 years ago when it was edited from our biblical text, although it seems to be something that's common knowledge in other cultures. So this ongoing project, yes, we get feedback and updated information, and they are ongoing research project, and to some degree they all dovetail together. So,
yeah, I can see the dovetailing when I actually started to read The Secrets of the Lost Mode of Prayer. When I was just looking at the cover and stuff, I didn't quite get it at first, but as soon as I started to read it, I was like, ah, okay, we're back to the field, is what
sure.
we are. Yeah.
What happened in the book, The Isaiah Effect, it covered so much material, and it was so broad in its scope that some of the really empowering bits of information were kind of lost. They were buried with all of the other research and things that were going on. So what this new book has taken one of the key elements regarding our relationship, the language that we use to speak with the forces of creation, and updated it with what we found as recently as 2005 when we were in the monasteries of Tibet.
And I want to get there, but
sure.
Tell me how that dovetails with the God Code. Explain the God Code for people that didn't catch the shows you were on with that or are unfamiliar with it.
The book, The God Code, was a result of a 12-year-long research project based in my belief, Ian, that I believe that we're here on purpose. I believe that we're an intentional species.
Right.
And in that belief, to me, it made tremendous sense as a scientist that somewhere in our ancient past, we would have been left some clue or some record telling us precisely that maybe we're not so different from one another, and the reasons that we go to war and the kind of wars we saw in the 20th century might be based on principles that are simply obsolete. If we're not that different from one another, why destroy ourselves over differences that don't exist? And it was by following clues, literal clues that were left in ancient texts and temple walls, we were able to make a mathematic link between the DNA of all life and the letters of ancient alphabets. That's just an absolutely, it's a mind-boggling concept to think that the sticky, gooey stuff in the cells of our bodies could in any way be linked to alphabets. But the mathematics is there, and we can talk about it if we want to go deeper. The bottom line to this study, however, was that when we use this mathematic link and we make the substitutions, taking the letters of ancient Hebrew, for example, or ancient Arabic or ancient Sanskrit,
yeah,
and we place them into the DNA of our bodies, the letters begin to spell words, the words begin to spell sentences, and then the sentences make sense. And the very first sentence that is almost like a header in a computer program or the introduction of a book is the same in all of the cells, and it literally reads and translates into the words, God eternal within the body. God eternal within the body. It doesn't say who or what God is, and there's a whole conversation we can have there, but the fact, and it is a fact, that this message is there demonstrates beyond any doubt that there's an intentionality underlying our existence. We're here on purpose, and that opens up the door to a vast array of possibilities.
I remember the first time I heard you say it, I just thought it was such a freak out. it unnerved me the rest of the night to think that that's true. And yet I find that fascinating because unlike our English or Western alphabets, all of the ancient alphabets, as you say, were connected to a numeric value as well.
Yeah.
So that makes a lot more sense that there's these connections that are going on. But are there more pieces to the puzzle that have come out since the book has?
It's an ongoing research project, Ian. What we found is that the DNA of all life exists in layers. And each layer has a separate code to translate that layer. And what you're asking right now is if I can share anything of the deeper layers, and we don't have anything confirmed to do that. I feel a responsibility in sharing this kind of information.
Oh, I think it's great. There was a story this week, again, about how closely our DNA is related to other non-human species on the planet, and in particular chimpanzees. The work that had previously been an estimation before has really gotten very specific. There's very few genetic differences between us and chimps. So have you ever looked at the code of chimps?
We have looked at the code of many forms of life. And what I can say right now, the closeness in the genetic language that you're talking about, it is ironic. There are 300 genes that separate us from a banana, for example, or a fruit fly. I mean, when you think about it that way, all life as we know it is what is called carbon-based life. And the DNA of all carbon-based life, the message reads the same. The very first layer, there are some pieces of the message that are identical, such as this header or the introduction, God within the body. And then as we go deeper into the code, that's where the differences come that make you different from me and that make us different from those chimps. And we are working diligently, and I promise that we will have more information along those lines, and I'd love to share it with our Coast to Coast listeners.
It's very cool.
Because the key here, it's so interesting that the book was actually released in 2004 in January, and it was right after that a brilliant physicist and author in his own right, Dr. Paul Davies, he's an astrobiologist from Sydney's University of in Macquarie. And he actually, at a mainstream conference, Ian, he opened the door to mainstream scientists for precisely the kind of thing we're talking about. What he said was that if an ancient life form or an ancient civilization left a message for us here in our world, they wouldn't have done it on the temple wall that could crumble over a few thousand years, or in a papyrus that could be destroyed in a temple fire like we saw in Alexandria.
Right.
He said it would be found in DNA itself, and he says, is it possible that DNA is a literal language, not just the metaphor as the language of all life? And that opened the door to the acceptance of the kinds of things that we're talking about tonight.
That's just fascinating. Well, I highly recommend it for people that haven't, the God Code and the Isaiah Effect. I wonder, with all of the changes going on in Israel, have they moved the scrolls, do you think?
They, to the best of my knowledge, they have not. And the scrolls I believe you're referring to are the Dead Sea Scrolls,
right.
Of all the scrolls that were found, the 900 that were eventually pieced together, the first seven were, interestingly, they were the most intact, and they're housed in a museum that's called the Shrine of the Book Museum. And the one scroll that is believed to be the most valued, the most significant of all, is the Great Isaiah Scroll. It's the one complete copy.
Yeah.
Of that scroll, and it is the one that is mounted, it's unrolled on a cylinder that's designed to retract, to drop into a concrete and steel vault under the floor with a steel door that closes over the top in the event of a direct nuclear attack on Israel, because it's believed that scroll, above all others, must survive for future generations. To the best of my knowledge, that scroll and the others that surround it are still there.
It's the coolest. I just totally love that. I think that's like the neatest thing I've ever heard.
It's a powerful body of information, and the fact that it is the only surviving copy in its completeness. I think that of the oldest record of that scroll in that portion of the Old Testament for over 2 billion people. It's the Old Testament.
Well, that's the most interesting thing about it is that this scroll, the Isaiah scroll too, and that from the Dead Sea Scrolls, it's almost its own kind of miracle that the Isaiah scroll they found, if memory serves, is almost letter for letter exactly like the Isaiah that any of us might have in a Bible in a drawer.
Well, the reason that that's true, Ian, is the reason that the God Code was so powerful, because in the Hebraic texts, the way that they have been perpetuated for thousands of years is that the scribe will sit down and transcribe letter for letter, one from the other. They have to be identical, because the belief is that the ancient Torah is the first five books of the Hebrew Bible is literally a map of the quantum possibilities that are available to us until the end of time. And if the scribe were to mistakenly change one of those letters and we mistook that letter or that word, that scribe would be responsible for changing the future of humankind and perhaps even the history. And this actually isn't a digression, it's a direct link to what we're going to do tonight, because the language of the Lost Mode of Prayer is the language that allows us to access those possibilities.
Yeah, but even still, I mean, there are scribal errors that pop up, and we know that they are there, and they do change the meaning of words and sentences, and especially Hebrew being a language without vowels, it's really important that every jot and tittle be exactly right, lest the whole meaning change.
It is, Ian, and that's why there are always exceptions. And it's rare that we can say always and never, but there are always exceptions to the rule. And in the difference between the oldest versions of the Hebrew Torah and the ones that we have in our hands or our Old Testament versions, there are only 23 letters that have changed over almost 5,000 years.
That is phenomenal. And the fact that Isaiah itself was the one that showed the least amount of variation, to me, was like the coolest. So, I mean, I don't know. There's a lot there to sort of piece together, and people can make connections as they will. And we are kind of dovetailing into Secrets of the Lost Mode of Prayer. Let me just say, first of all, about the book, because it's a little bit unlike some of your other books. It's a smaller book. It's a contemplative book. And it's got a very padded cover. What was the padded cover about?
Well, here's what happened. Our publisher is Hay House, and they have a division in their publishing house called the Lifestyles Division. And those books are a little different than the kinds of books that you would typically see as reference material. And this book is very different for me, where other books have been a little wordy and a little more technical, and they had to be for credibility.
Right. Sure.
This book is it's very easy to read. It's very plain language. It has full color photographs of the temples and the monasteries where we found this information, and it is very concise in five poignant sections. It describes this language, a non-denominational, non-religious language that the ancients called a form of prayer, that is actually a quantum language speaking to the possibilities that Western physicists now acknowledge exist in our world.
Well, all I can say is if my wife, for whatever reason, if I ever irritate that redhead and she ever wants to throw a book at me, I hope it's this book.
Well,
it's got this nice padded cover on it.
It's called a puffy book. And
puffy book.
What happened? It was so interesting, Ian. When the manuscript went through the various departments with the publisher, they shared with me how each of them developed their own relationship, a special relationship with this material, from the editors to the designers to the marketing people and the publicists. They all had a very special feeling about they could relate to pieces of this book in a way that was very empowering in their lives. And to me, that's a good sign. It says that we found a language that transcends the differences and the judgments about who we are and how we relate in the world, and hopefully can share something useful and meaningful in our lives.
I know we will. And all I can say is I may cut up the cover and put it in the soles of my shoes.
Can I quote you on that? That'll be one of my endorsements from Ian.
Is that a charcoal inside of that? Because it feels like a Dr. Scholl's pad outside.
Yeah, I'm not sure what they did. It was
I want to take a nap on it. That's what I want to do.
It is a brightly colored cover, and there is a padding on the inside. And it is a small format book. People describe it as a prayer book. They carry it in their purses.
I can see that. And it is a kind of prayer book, although it isn't the kind of prayer that people might expect. And it follows completely along the pattern of Greg's work over the years. Well, let's just get started. We're coming up on a break, and so we'll break it off here in just a moment. But what was your first tip on this? Well, how did you first get started in this journey that led you to that monastery in Tibet?
Well, what we know, Ian, that Western prayer researchers today identify four modalities of prayer. And this is the word, this is their language, their terminology. Four modes of prayer, they say, that we use in the West today. And I want to be very clear when we speak about this tonight that I know prayer is a deep and personal topic to everyone. There are no wrong ways to pray. There are no incorrect ways to pray. However, in our journeys into Egypt and Bolivia and little villages in the Andes Mountains of Peru and into Tibet and into Nepal, all through the desert southwest of North America, we've always found references to a mode of prayer that simply did not fit those four modes of prayer. And I asked myself, could there be another mode, a fifth mode or a lost mode? And lo and behold, what we find is it is a mode of prayer that was edited from the Western biblical traditions in the 4th century on the one hand, and on the other hand, we find records of this of the books and of the texts in the Tibetan monasteries that have been pretty much undisturbed from the 1st century until the overthrow in 1959.
Well, let's leave it there for the moment and come back to this thought that there are four traditionally accepted modes of prayer, and then this fifth one, which has been there all along, just waiting to be rediscovered. And I'll go with you coming up here just a second on that idea that you just said about there are no wrong ways to pray. I think there's one, and I'll tell you what that is too coming up. It's a very interesting idea, and it applies to anybody and everybody at any time, everywhere. The lost mode of prayer. And we'll talk about the human to divine interface that exists in a technological field that can be measured. It's the work of Greg Braden. Next, it's Coast to Coast Live. My name's Ian Punnett. It's like science night on Coast to Coast. Coming up on Coast to Coast AM, Art Bell's going to be talking theoretical physics with a professor from Harvard, and he is a scientist, a computer scientist, as well as a technician, who started studying the technology of the divine, if you will. And that took him to the Secrets of the Lost Mode of Prayer. That's the new book out by Greg Braden. What are the four modalities commonly associated with prayer in the West? What was the missing fifth one? And his journey in discovering it and how he first experienced it next all across North America. It's Saturday night, and this is Coast to Coast Live.
Sad world. This is Coast to Coast Live with Ian Punnett.
That's such a cool song. Totally love that song. Secrets of the Lost Mode of Prayer. Greg Braden is onto something here, and I hope we haven't built it up too much. It's my only fear. Because it's so simple that I wonder whether when we actually get down to cases with it coming up in just a second, that most people listening will just go, duh. Except there's so much more to that duh. So much so that I think if you consider that this taps into something so much deeper and so much more simply than you have probably ever attempted in the past with a prayer, that maybe that duh will turn into a doh, and you wish you'd always prayed like this. We'll explain it exactly the way it exists right now, whether we're doing it or not. Praying with that human to divine interface that is the field all around us. Next on Coast to Coast Live, this is Ian Punnett. We'll start poking at this interface between the human and the divine coming up in just a moment. Let's just pick up, though, where we were with Greg Braden and the book, The Secrets of the Lost Mode of Prayer. Typically, what are the four modes of prayer that most people would be familiar with?
Well, Western prayer researchers identify these modes, so this is their terminology. The first is what is called a colloquial or an informal prayer. It's something we all use. It's where we get into a tight spot, something catches us off guard, and we simply ask for help in our own language. It's not a formal prayer. Dear God, I have a friend, actually, in the Bay Area who used to use an informal prayer every Friday night coming home from work. Dear God, if you let my car get to the filling station at the end of the 680 freeway before it runs out of gas, I'll never let the tank get this low again.
And he did it every week.
And then next week, same prayer. But that's an example of what they call a colloquial or an informal prayer.
Okay.
The second modality is what is called a petitionary prayer, and there are some traditions that petition the powers to be, that petition God or angels. Mighty I Am, I petition for the right to heal and be healed now and all past, present, and future manifestations is an example of a petitionary form of prayer. The third form is what we call a ritualistic prayer, where we say the same words at a certain time of day or a certain time of year, a certain number of times. God is great, God is good,
right.
Or now I lay me down to sleep. And the fourth mode of prayer that is controversial in and of itself, it's what is called meditative prayer. Some people believe it may not even be a form of prayer at all, but we'll define that here in just a few moments. But the meditative prayer is where we're simply aware of a greater presence and our role in that presence as it surrounds us.
A silent prayer, if you will.
Yes.
Not one where one isn't necessarily trying to form words about it, but that's different even from the lost mode of prayer, which we will get back to. In the first one, the informal, when I was in seminary, Greg?
Yes.
We called that the God as valet prayer.
That's one I haven't heard.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah, that's one of those, you know, I really need a parking space here, God. If you can really, you know, that's that God as valet prayer. And oddly enough, though, and I don't know whether it would fall under a category here, but you don't have the what they call the imprecatory or the curse psalms. I don't know where they would fall into these, but of course these are prayers of the Book of Psalms in which people yell at God. They yell angrily at God. And I always find that to be a very interesting mode of prayer in and of itself, in that it follows an emotional form of prayer in which one just kind of cathartically just kind of screams out all of the things that are going wrong with their life. They're not petitioning in the sense that they're listing, saying, okay, do this and please do that and don't forget so-and-so, but rather it's just this very emotive form of almost like cursing the world as a way of getting God to notice one.
If they're using prescribed words that have been handed down in the text, sometimes those are considered ritualistic then.
Yeah, oddly enough, I think, though, the imprecatory psalms are just kind of snapshots of that mode of prayer, of sort of angrily yelling at God. I think that's interesting. And there are, I was going to say, just in a conversation I had with somebody once, and I just love the way they term this, they said that there's only one way to pray wrong, and that is a blasphemous prayer, in which one doesn't really care whether they're just sort of praying out of rote. They don't care. And there's lots of people that offer meaningless, blasphemous prayers all the time because it's blasphemous because it doesn't take, if you'll pardon the expression, it doesn't take God's time seriously. It doesn't really treat God as important. It's just more important that we say these nice words without any meaning or care to them whatsoever.
Well, Ian, this is the crux of what this lost modality is all about. And if that is true, that those prayers are simply words, there's a good possibility those prayers may go unanswered. And that is the frustration for people. They wonder why. I said the words, why isn't my prayer answered? And that leads back to the question that you asked me just before the break. What is it that took us into the monasteries of Tibet or the temples of Egypt to find this?
Where did you know where to go?
We followed the records. I began this research when I was working in the industry, in the defense industry, during the last years of the Cold War. And it was, as a scientist, I was trained to look to the world outside of me, the world around me, to find the answers. So I began looking in the oldest records of those cultures, and the irony was that all the records said, stop looking out here. They said, you're not going to find what you're looking for in the world around you. You've got to look within. Of course, we've all heard that, and many times we think it's simply a metaphor. In the case of the God Code, I simply took it literally. I said, if there is a link between us and a greater presence, and all the traditions and the texts and the temple walls and the creation stories tell us to look within, maybe it's literal. If so, where would we look? And that was what led to the search in the DNA. So in this case, however, the text suggested that there is a link between the wisdom of our world today and our ancient past. And some of that wisdom has been passed down in the written format, some in the oral format, and the written records have changed over time for a number of reasons. Some of them were intentionally edited, some were destroyed, some were lost. So it made sense to me, Ian, to go into the oldest records that had been least disturbed by Western civilization, and that made China and the highlands of central China, Tibet, a good candidate because it was closed to the West until 1980.
Okay, so even still, that sounds like a needle in a haystack. I mean, it's not like Tibet. Tibet's not like Indiana. I mean,
well, so we'll just take about a half a step back, and I'm going to introduce a couple of sentences of science that we can tie into throughout the rest of the program. It was during the last years of the 20th century, between 1993 and the year 2000, under laboratory conditions, that scientists confirmed something that all those ancient texts had always stated was so, but we never really had the evidence to prove to us that we are, in fact, bathed in a field of intelligent energy. There's a field or a force that permeates all of creation, and it is what's called a non-conventional form of energy. So it doesn't work like electricity, and because of that, we never had the equipment to measure this because we're trying to measure conventional forms of energy. It was only in the last few years, in the last 10 years of the 20th century, that these experiments showed, number one, that the field was there. And it has a lot of different names, everything from the quantum hologram to the mind of God to nature's mind, and we can talk about all of those. But number two, Ian, and this is where it links into this mode of prayer, it showed that human DNA and human emotion have a direct link into this field, that something that we do in our lives communicates and changes what's happening in this field. And this field is essentially the blueprint for what happens in the healing of our bodies and the peace between nations. And it is in those texts where I found the clearest records of how this interface applies that we chose to look into those sites. And for that reason, we chose to go into those Tibetan monasteries, because it's a living culture. They use this interface all the time. And there is a power that comes from sitting down and looking at another man or another woman, a monk or a nun or an abbot, and we look at them in their eyes. And we say, when we see you doing these things, healing these people's bodies, or when we see you doing this mode of prayer on the outside, we can actually ask them. We say, what are you doing on the inside? How'd you do that? How'd you make that happen? And that's something that we cannot do from a temple wall, or we can't do from a Mayan codex or something like that, although the information may be there. We're guessing to some degree. So we just covered a lot of ground in a few minutes, but we can tie into all that.
I got to unpack some of this first.
Sure.
All right. First of all, when you go back to the idea of this, the instruments that can measure this field, what does that instrument look like? And what does it actually show? Does it look like an infrared camera, or does it show like heat sensing, binoculars, or what? I mean, what does it show?
Well, this part of the discussion, actually, Art was probably going to talk about this with the physicist that we heard the introduction from.
Well, let's ruin his show and talk about it now, I say.
It all goes back to an experiment that was conducted in 1887. Very famous experiment. It was called the Michelson-Morley experiment, because it was during that time that modern science, were considered modern science during that time, there was a great debate as to whether or not this field of energy actually exists, whether this intelligence that connects everything in the universe actually is there. And they devised an experiment. It was a good experiment for its time. It was interpreted poorly. Let me just give you the idea is that there's a static field of intelligence and that permeates all of the universe. And if that is true, as Earth moves through space, it is moving through this field, and it should create what was called a breeze or a wind. And at that time, the field was called the ether. So the experiment was designed to detect what is called the ether wind. The equivalent of this experiment, Ian, if listeners could just imagine going outside their homes right now and moistening their index finger and holding it above their head, and in the moment that they do that, they feel no wind against their finger, and from that conclude that no air exists. That would be the equivalent of this field. They detected no movement in the field, so therefore, they concluded that the field doesn't even exist. And for over 100 years now, Western science, as good as it is, has been lacking in this respect, in that we assume that nothing is connected, that everything is separate from one another, that empty space is truly empty. And it was only with some very innovative experiments between 1993 and 2000, all involving human DNA, by the way, that they were able to validate that this field, in effect, is there. So just a little background. Mm. And we'll never call it the ether field again, because it's got such a bad name in physics. So now this field is called everything from, as we said, the quantum hologram to nature's mind to the mind of God. But what scientists now know, a series of experiments were conducted, and the bottom line for these experiments were, number one, the field exists. Number two, apparently it's been here since the beginning of time that we consider the Big Bang, and there's controversy around that. And then number three, the field appears to be intelligent in that it responds to very precise kinds of human emotion, and that is what ties this field back into the lost mode of prayer.
Just for the record, I wouldn't call it the methane wind either. mean, that would be wrong. But what can we see? I mean, is it? I mean, if it's measurable, if it's quantifiable, is there a way that? I mean, can we ever capture an image that shows the connectivity of this energy in the field?
I've never seen an image, although it might be out there, Ian. What we see are the effects, the experiments that are designed specifically that can only occur if there is something connecting two somethings together. So, for example, let's just talk about what this is. One of the experiments was done at the University of Geneva by a gentleman named Nicholas Jizen, and it involved two particles of the stuff our world is made out of, photons, two twin particles. They began at a single point in time. They were fired in opposite directions in a very specific apparatus, and when they were 14 miles apart from one another, I don't know how much detail we want to go into the experiment, when they were 14 miles apart from one another, what happened was when there was a change that was created in one of these particles, the other particle always assumed the same change.
Get out.
Even though they're separated by this distance of 14 miles.
Get out.
And sometimes, in some cases, the change occurred almost before it even happened, suggesting the information was traveling from one particle to the other faster than the speed of light. And what physics tells us today is that information cannot travel faster than the speed of light. And what we'll find in this conversation tonight is because of this field, it's very possible the information never traveled at all.
I could totally get that.
And this is the power. We're talking about abstract things. We're talking about electrons, protons, bilocation, time travel, things traveling faster than the speed of light. That's all interesting, but what good is it if it doesn't mean something in our lives? What does that mean to us? Because we're made out of electrons and protons and those particles that are having those very bizarre quantum experiences. The question is there a way that those things can be meaningful in our lives? And this is the interface that ancient traditions understood, and many still do today. It's like the great secret, Ian, that everybody knows outside of the Western culture. But because the information that tells us how we interact with the forces of our world, because that information was lost in the 4th century, to us this stuff looks weird. Physicists actually call it spooky action.
Right.
They say this is quantum weirdness and spooky action. On the one hand, the other hand, people are healing their bodies from cancers, and we've seen this in a live video. I've seen this, and that's why I can speak with it from a place of conviction, because it may not be that they are so anomalous in the world. These fundamental particles may be telling us how the world really works, how the universe works, and how we can apply those kinds of things in our lives in a way that's meaningful to us. So.
Well, the G word has come up a couple of times, so let me just ask you, as a scientist, as a computer specialist, as a technician, as somebody who's interested in physics, what is God?
Oh, we're going to start with the easy questions now in the first hour of the program.
And you have a minute.
From my personal perspective, I'll begin by saying I was not raised, I was raised in a conservative Midwestern community in Kansas City, Missouri. With no specific religion, although I had visibility to a lot of different religions.
Sure.
And I'm just as comfortable in a Native American prayer ceremony as I am in a mosque or a synagogue or a cathedral. So my idea has always been that there is an intelligence, although not perhaps a personal intelligence, that's out there. And the fact that we have a message in the cells of our bodies, for me, validates and confirms that we are part of a greater existence, part of a greater intelligence. Now, when we talk about God, we define God as a presence that is everywhere, all the time. It's always been here, and it knows what we're thinking. That's what we're told when we're young people.
Right.
Except for the language, that sounds precisely like the field of intelligence that we're talking about that quantum physics now has validated. It's a field everywhere, all the time. It's always been here, and it responds. It will change our world and change our bodies if we know the language to request that change in a meaningful way.
that brings us to the secrets of the lost mode of prayer, the hidden power of beauty, of blessing, of wisdom, and hurt. Greg Braden, when we come back from this break, it's high time. We break it down. What is the lost mode of prayer? How does that tie into this idea of quantum physics as a connection between all of us? And how can we use it to change our lives for the good next on Coast to Coast Live? Secrets of the Lost Mode of Prayer, the new book out by Greg Braden, following on The God Code and the Isaiah Effect. And if the title sounds unlike the other two, well, so does the subject matter itself when you actually get into it. It is a little bit more like a prayer book than the other two books have been, exploring perhaps more precisely the relationship between technology and faith. And yet, in this case, the secrets of the lost mode of prayer hit on something which is perhaps more scientific than I think people ever thought that prayer could ever be. Again, Greg mentioned last hour, informal prayer was one mode of prayer, petitionary prayer, ritualistic, and the meditative kind of prayer. But this was something new and old at the same time. And it wasn't just at a Tibetan monastery. It was also with a Native American tradition, wasn't it, that you came across this?
Well, once we identified it, Ian, in one place very clearly, and that was in the monasteries in Tibet, what we found is that in principle it's actually practiced in many indigenous cultures and referenced in ancient texts, actual instructions. And I'll share some of those. We're left in ancient texts.
Well, so Buckminster Fuller once said about God that he said God is a verb, not a noun. And I kept thinking about that as I was reading The Secrets of the Lost Mode of Prayer. God as a verb, God as an action, God as an energy, as opposed to God as a being. And I don't know how you feel about that, but tell me, when you first encountered this lost mode of prayer, did you understand what was happening while you saw it?
I did, and I'll tell you the reason why, Ian, because it makes perfect sense to me that if we are in fact the product of an intentional creation, as the God Code suggests that we are, the message in our DNA, if we are here on purpose and there's an intelligent field permeates all of creation, to me it makes perfect sense that in some way we would be able to communicate with that field in a meaningful way that has an impact in our lives. And again, except for the language, the way this field works sounds precisely the way the ancients described the power of God.
Take us through the first time you saw somebody using this.
The very first time I saw it firsthand, I had the opportunity to study with an Oriental master who was using this, although they didn't call it prayer, they were using these techniques and other techniques to effect a healing inside the body of a woman who had been diagnosed with an inoperable cancer by Western doctors. It was a cancer in her bladder. And through the magic of ultrasound, we were able to look inside of her body and actually see real time her body respond to something that the practitioners were doing outside of her body. And in less than 3 minutes, 2 minutes and 40 seconds, what we literally saw was the condition that Western medicine had believed was inoperable disappeared. The cancer was literally gone. Physical matter responded to the non-physical effects of something that another person did inside their bodies. And for all intents and purposes, that is the way that we identify this lost mode of prayer. It's something that we do. There are no words or no outward expressions. It's something, it's a condition that we create inside of our bodies that on the quantum level affects the world beyond our bodies.
You didn't happen to have a camera running, did you?
Well, there is. We do have a video. We show this in the programs, and there are links on our on the website. People are interested in seeing.
That should have made the nightly news.
You know, I've shown it many times for probably the last 5 years. I've shown it in medical conventions. I've shown it in live audiences. It is the subject of a documentary that will be released probably within the next 60 days. And almost to the program, the results are the same. People, first they see it and they say, wow, you know, we're absolutely amazed. They're in awe. There's silence in the audience. And then the doctors and the scientists say, you know, it's a miracle. It deserves study. And we're going to come back and look at it as soon as we find the cure for cancer. Because to them, there's such a disconnect that mirrors the disconnect in our culture, in our belief. It says that we are completely separate from the world around us, and that our beliefs, our thoughts, feelings, emotions, really, they're not really things. They're just these experiences that we have. They're actually discouraged, up until recently anyway. Human emotion has been discouraged in the West, and especially in males, on the one hand. On the other hand, it is the very power, the very force that rearranges matter on the quantum level and creates these kinds of effects, and it's the very force that was described in the texts that were edited from the Western Bible in the 4th century. So we'll come back through the next couple of hours. We'll tie into all of these.
All right. So, and for, just in case somebody missed it, and we let's amplify it a little bit more.
Sure.
This lost mode of prayer, when you describe it to somebody, how do you put it in a nutshell?
Well, what I'd like to do, you know, I'd like to summarize those three experiments, because they will be the anchor, the rock that we can hang all this on. And I'm going to look to you for I'll follow your lead for how much detail you'd like. But I'd like in a couple of sentences to summarize each of those three experiments and then tie them together to lay the foundation for this question. You okay if we get that way?
Yeah, I've had it. Yeah, sure.
Three experiments that were done, some of them described in this book, some in the Isaiah Effect, and they're documented on our website as well. The first one was done by a Russian quantum physicist, Vladimir Poponin, who was investigating the relationship between human DNA and photons, the energy packets that our world is made of. I mean, a very high level, we can think of it that way. And right there, it tells you something interesting has happened, because there's nothing, absolutely nothing in Western science that says that DNA should have any effect on the stuff our world is made of. But here's an experiment that was designed to investigate this possibility. And what they found was in what is called a vacuum, where all the air is taken out, we know that there are photons left. And they measured these photons to see if they were randomly scattered, if they were all piled up in the bottom of this container. And they were scattered, and that's exactly what they had expected would happen. The second part of the experiment, they put the human DNA in to the container, and the photons all became aligned along this pattern of DNA. The DNA had a direct effect on the stuff our world is made of. It's the first time that I'm aware of, under laboratory conditions, this has ever been documented, although ancient traditions always say that we have an effect in our world. Here is DNA actually changing the way that matter is behaving.
Okay, but when we say DNA, mm-hmm. What do you mean by that? Was it a strand of DNA?
Was it
microscopic? Was it blood?
Human DNA in the cells that were in a solution, and there was no human attached to that DNA in this experiment. Okay, so the first experiment, DNA is having an effect on the stuff our world is made of.
Yeah, but if you could just draw that picture a little bit more clearly for me. So in the vacuum, in this tube, I mean, they can see, what, microscopically, that they're, protons are kind of floating everywhere?
They're measuring optically and chemically. They're measuring the photons, particles of light. And they're scattered in this tube.
Okay, and then they inject DNA, meaning just like your average kind of long helix?
Sure, the double strand of human DNA. They isolate the DNA, they place it into this vacuum, and there's nothing in Western physics, Ian, that suggests that the presence of that DNA should have any effect on those photons at all. And what they find, and what they document, is that just the opposite happens. The photons actually change. They align themselves. They rearrange where they are in this vacuum in the presence of the DNA.
That's so, too cool.
So this, okay, that's the first experiment. Now, the second one was a military experiment where human DNA was taken from a donor in one room and placed into a device in another room in the same building, and it was measured to see what response the DNA would have when the donor was having an emotional experience.
Get out.
So here's what's happening. We'll just do this real quick.
This is back to the photons being shot in different directions. Right?
Well, here it is.
I mean, it's sort of like that experiment all over again.
It is, except now there's a human factor, and
right.
this is going to lay the foundation for this lost mode of prayer, and we're going to tie all these together magically before we go to our next break.
I hope we better, or people will kill us.
Well,
I'm just telling you, because if we drag it out any longer,
Here's what's happening.
Okay.
The donor is watching graphic video clips in one room and having genuine emotions, while his DNA, hundreds of feet away in another room, is having, when he has his emotions, the DNA is having its peaks, it's changing. And when he's having his emotional dips, the DNA is having its dips. And I actually spoke to the gentleman that designed this experiment. His name is Dr. Cleve Baxter. If you ever read the book, The Secret Life of Plants, it's about
research
that he did. Oh, sure.
Right, yeah.
Well, he told me that he carried the experiments even further to 350 miles away, and they used atomic clocks to see how long it would take for the emotion of the donor to change the donor's DNA. And the answer is it took zero time. The effect is instantaneous, whether they're in the same room or they're 350 miles apart. And that's going to be important for something we do before the end of the evening.
Okay, but that's almost creepy.
Well,
I mean, that's almost like a bad horror movie where somebody has their arm, you know, implanted in another person and they can, you know what I mean?
Think of the implications. What does it mean for organ transplants? Does it mean when your organ, if the organ from a living person ends up in another body, are they still connected in some way? Or even more than that, we shake hands and hug and touch people many times every day, and some of our DNA is exchanged. Are we connected in some way?
Oh, it's fascinating.
These are the implications. But the bottom line, the second experiment, is that human emotion was having a direct effect on the DNA, and the effect was there even when it wasn't in the donor's body. The third experiment was done through an organization, you may have had them on the show before, the Institute of Heart Math in Northern California, where they were investigating the effects of human emotion on DNA specifically, and what they found was that very precise kinds of emotion, that's called coherent emotion, changes the shape of the DNA. That they were holding DNA that had been isolated in glass tubes, creating emotions that we would call appreciation, gratitude, love, compassion. And in the presence of those emotions, the DNA would elongate. In the presence of anger, hate, rage, and jealousy, the DNA contracts. And we could do a whole program on those implications. But when you put these three experiments together, Ian, and the reason I'm sharing them now, individually they're interesting. When you put them together, they begin to tell a story. And the story is this. The first experiment shows that DNA has an effect on the stuff our world is made of. The second, or the third experiment shows that human emotion is changing the DNA that's having the effect on the stuff our world is made of. And the second one says whether it's in the same room or 350 miles away, doesn't make any difference. The effect is there. And that's the beginning of the technology, the inner technology that the ancients talk to us about and that we think is miraculous in our world, that we can create an emotion inside of our bodies that has effects that extend beyond our bodies. And this is the lost mode of prayer. It is an emotion-based prayer. No words, no outward expressions, very precise kinds of emotion that change the chemistry of our bodies and change the quantum world beyond our bodies. And the instructions are documented in 2,500-year-old texts.
Yeah, and this, just before we go into greater detail on that, it also makes me wonder about the experiments make me wonder about men and women who have lost a limb and still feel that limb, and whether or not there is something that extends outside of their body to the contours of the limb that had previously been there.
Sure. Well, this opens the door, and that's what I said. There are many places in our conversation tonight, Ian,
yeah.
You and I know this, where one topic could be the entire program, and this is one of those places. But it goes back to the work of Sheldrake, Rupert Sheldrake's work with the morphogenic fields, and the template, the energetic template that precedes the physical in our world, and that is precisely what all this it all ties together. It all dovetails together.
Well, so let's though unpack that a little bit more on the idea of the emotional aspect of this prayer. That the lost mode of prayer, it doesn't mean praying ritualistically with enthusiasm. It doesn't mean an informal prayer in which one infuses humor. The idea here is that one doesn't pray with words or petitions or even necessarily perhaps even images, although I guess that would be okay. But the idea here is that you would pray only with the present tense of an emotion.
So precisely, and what we're doing is we're at a high level, we're describing this, and then we're going to go into greater levels of detail. So at a high level, this prayer is a prayer where we are invited to feel the feeling in our hearts as if the prayer has already been answered.
And that's the key thing, because it isn't feeling the anticipation of joy of what would happen if this prayer were answered, or even feeling love and just sort of saying, you know, gratitude to the universe for all the wonderful blessings that have come my way. But, and I think the example of your Native American friend who mm-hmm. took you out in the desert, that sure. explains a lot. Can you tell that story real quick?
Sure, and it's probably one of the most powerful teaching tools for this kind of prayer, and I'll do it, I'll be very as concise as I can. It was the early 1990s when near my home in northern New Mexico, when the desert southwest was having one of the worst droughts that the elders could remember in over 100 years. And a friend of mine, a native friend, asked if I wanted to join him in a prayer of rain. And he didn't have to ask twice. I said, sure, you bet. And we went to a place that his ancestors had created where he said, his words were that the skin between the worlds is thin here. He said this is like an access point, essentially.
I love that.
And I wasn't prepared for what I saw, because as an Anglo, I thought, you know, at least I was going to see some chanting or some movement. But he honored all of his ancestors. He literally said the words, all of my ancestors, as he stepped into this ancient stone circle, honored the four directions. He closed his eyes. He assumed a prayer mudra in front, held his fingertips and palms together in front of his heart. And just a few seconds, he turned around and he looked at me and he said, I'm hungry. You want me to get a bite to eat? And I said, well, I thought you were going to pray for rain. And this one, he looked at me and he said, no. He said, because if I prayed for rain, rain could never happen. And I said, I thought that was why we came to this place. And he said, no. He said, when you pray for something to happen, you acknowledge that it is not so in that moment, and you may actually reinforce the very condition that you'd like to change. And I said, what did you do? And he said, I didn't pray for rain. He said, I felt the feeling as if the rain had already happened. And he told me how he went about doing that, by smelling the smells of the rain coming off the Pueblo walls in his village, feeling mud in his feet. And he gave gratitude and appreciation and thanks for the rain in that way. And he said, this is the difference between asking for something to happen and feeling as if it's already occurred.
Well, we're going to then explore a few more of those secrets of the lost mode of prayer. Perhaps do a little experiment next on Coast to Coast Live. Greg Braden, talking about his new book, Secrets of the Lost Mode of Prayer, and how that ties into his other work, which makes connections between both religion and science, and perhaps probably more accurately, between the human and the divine. And we'll continue to explore this interface. You just heard a very interesting story about the thin places, a place where his Native American friend took him out into the desert to pray rain, not pray for rain, which would accentuate the fact that we were living in a state of lack, but to pray rain, feeling the present moment of rain. Now, did it work? That's the key part. If this is a true lost mode of prayer, if it has a level of efficacy that truly can manipulate the field, the energy that's out there, if it's real, then what happened after that prayer of rain, a prayer for not for, but of rain? We'll find out next with Greg Braden on Coast to Coast Live. Well, it's kind of like science night here on Coast to Coast. Later with Art Bell on Coast to Coast AM, he'll be talking about alternative views on physics, exploring theoretical physics with Lisa Randall from Harvard. But we're talking about it in a different way with Greg Braden, Secrets of the Lost Mode of Prayer. So here's your Native American friend. He goes out to what he calls one of these thin places between the human world and the divine, a circle out in the middle of the desert. He prays rain for a moment or two, then turns to you and says, you know, let's go to IHOP or whatever, let's get flapjacks, and you guys are out of there. But what happened afterward? Did you get the rain?
Well, we did, and I knew we were coming up on a break, and I wanted to complete that thought. I want to elaborate a little bit on what he did, because I looked at him, and I said, I thought you were going to pray for rain, and he said, if the listeners weren't with us before the break, he said, no. He said, if I pray for something, I am, in that moment, I'm affirming the fact that it hasn't happened yet. He said, what I did was I felt the feeling of what it feels like to feel with my naked feet in the mud in our Pueblo village because there's been so much rain. And he said, I smelled the smells of what it smells like when the rainwater falls off the earthen walls of our Pueblo village, and I felt what it feels like to walk through chest-high fields of corn, and the corn is that high because there's been so much rain. So he engaged all of his senses, or a number of his senses.
Right.
There were no words, and there was no, for all intents and purposes, no outward expression. It's a feeling.
Right.
We go back to those experiments, and we know that a certain kind of feeling has a direct effect on our physical world. And this is what the experiments are showing us. Something we do in our bodies affects the forces of nature that extend beyond our bodies into our physical world. And if we understand that, it's a technology. If we don't, we call it a miracle. And it's just like the healing that happened with the woman's cancer.
Right.
Precisely.
So if we're going to look at it scientifically, I mean, bear with me, and I'm the dumbest guy I know, but the thought here is that in a way, his prayer is exciting his DNA, which then in turn excites the photons, which in turn excites the rain. I mean, am I getting close?
Sure. You can think of it that way, or it's simply a communication that the non-physical effects is what we create in our emotions. The DNA translates that into the physical aspects, the physical manifestation, through the Play-Doh of the universe that we call this field out there. It's a neutral, unbiased field. It simply mirrors back to us what it is that we give it to work with. He gave it the feeling of rain so that the field could mirror rain back to him. The practitioners in the healing of the woman, we didn't even follow up on this one to the extent that we could have. They felt the feeling, the way they affected that healing, is they didn't buy into the illusion of that woman's cancer and say, you know, bad tumor, we've got to make you go away, or we're going to cut you out or irradiate you. They acknowledge that that is one possibility of many possibilities. So they didn't have a judgment about it. And what they did was they felt the feeling as if they were in the presence of a woman who was fully enabled, fully capacitated, fully healed. And in that feeling, and in the training that they had to create that kind of feeling, her body, her physical body, responded to that non-physical feeling in 2 minutes and 40 seconds. Princeton University physicist John Wheeler, I bet they'll talk about this in the next hour, is one of the pioneers. He was a colleague of Albert Einstein. He's still with us. And he has coined a term that is absolutely shaking the foundations of the way we think about physics in our world today. The prevailing view has been that we live in a universe that was birthed 15 to 20 billion years ago. It's been around for a while. We're relative latecomers passing through as casual observers. But what the new studies are showing, and the very essence of quantum physics, and what John Wheeler is suggesting, is that it's not that we are passive observers, that the act of consciousness is what creates our universe. He calls this a participatory universe, is the term that he coined. Not controlling, not manipulating. He says that we participate in the events that unfold in our lives, and we do it in ways we're only beginning to understand. And human emotion is part of the language that we use to participate.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to.
Well, I just want to be clear. Wheeler doesn't say that emotion does. That's a Greg Bradenism. But John Wheeler is the one that coined the term participatory universe. He's suggesting that rather than being latecomers passing through the universe, that the universe may be here because of consciousness, that the universe may be the result of an act of consciousness, which is completely foreign concept in terms of the way that we've always thought of ourselves in the world before. But this is this lost mode of prayer. The other modes of prayer where we feel powerless in a situation, and this mode of prayer says that we're part of everything that happens. We're part of all that we see and all that we experience, and by virtue of that, we have the opportunity, if we choose, to participate. We don't have to.
It sounds a lot like the Matrix.
Well, it's interesting. Where do those things come from?
Right. Yeah, I mean, it really does. It sort of sounds like only what you are willing to participate in.
Well, if you think there are researchers out there who are making the comparison of consciousness as the operating system in a massive cosmic computer, and of us as application programs, the PowerPoint or the Excel in that operating system, and rather than change consciousness to affect our world, to heal our bodies and bring about peace, if you want to do that in a computer, you don't change the operating system. You find a way to speak to the operating system, and the same principle applies. We're not going to change consciousness. We're finding the language that's meaningful to consciousness. And emotion, human emotion, is one part of that language. And interestingly enough, it's the one part that was lost to the West 1,700 years ago.
It sounds
fascinating.
Sounds all the more like Bill Gates is like a god. in a way of being the owner of the operating system.
Well, Ian, I want to read your new book now when it comes out, where you pull all this together in a way that everybody can really get it. You break it down in a very clear, concise way.
Well, I'll write that book if you write the foreword to it. Okay?
I'd be absolutely honored and thrilled.
Okay. All right. Now, by the way, when you say next hour, when we're talking about the physicists, just so you know, we got one more hour left, so don't think you're getting off early.
Right. No, I understand. Why isn't it? We get to talk to some of our listeners the next.
Oh yeah, we do. So I just say, don't leave on me yet. I'm just getting it.
Okay.
All right. So, but back to this idea, because I'd love to do an experiment of that before we end this hour. Okay.
Sure.
And perhaps we get a better sense when we're talking about sort of praying something, not praying for it, but being in it. That. It doesn't matter how long that feeling is, right? I mean, in the energy field, it's not a matter of it's got to be a minimum of 15 seconds or it's got to be – it simply is for the moment, and that moment can be, whatever, left up to the individual.
It can work that way. And just to kind of solidify what this means, if I could share it from a couple of different perspectives, one contemporary and one actually – the original translation before it was edited from the biblical text where these instructions actually are actually found.
Would this be in the Gnostic texts?
No, this is actually
apocryphal?
The book of John.
Okay.
So all of our readers can go out and they can see the edited version, and then I'll read to them the unedited translations.
So this is the Gospel of John or in the Epistles of John?
The Gospel of John.
Okay, all right. So in the Gospel of John,
well,
what does it say?
Well, before we do that, in the contemporary, in the 20th century, there was a brilliant and seldom heard of visionary mystic. His name was Neville, who talked in very plain terms about precisely these principles. And what he said, people say, how do you do this? And in Neville's words, what he said is, he said, to have these feelings, you must abandon yourself to your wish or your prayer already fulfilled. And in doing so, live the new state and no more in the old state. So my native friend lived knowing that rain was coming that afternoon, and those practitioners knew in that moment that the woman was already healed. There wasn't a question or saying, you know, gee, I hope this works, or, you know, the camera's on us. What happens if it doesn't work?
Right.
It wasn't like that. In the Gospels, we've all heard this before, and this is where, at the beginning of the program, you said, you know, some people are going to hear this and say, you know, it's so simple. It's too simple. We've all heard, ask and you shall receive. I know we've
right.
heard that before.
Right.
In the edited version, the way that that translation comes about, it says, ask and ye shall receive that your joy may be full. So, you know, it's informative, but it doesn't really talk a lot about how to do that. In the and that's in the book of John. In the the original text before it was translated, if you go back, Neil Douglas Cloetz has done this in a little book called Prayers of the Cosmos, is one of the places where you can find the original Aramaic. Subtle but powerful differences in the words. The original, unedited version says, ask without hidden motive and be surrounded by your answer. Be enveloped by what you desire, that your gladness be full.
That's very interesting.
So it's not something you do. When you be, it means just what Neville said. You assume and come from the place in your life as if that has already happened. This one piece in here, ask without hidden motive, is also a key. The physicist Amit Goswami talks about this. He said to create, we live in a world where we create our reality. He says, but we don't create it in the ordinary state of consciousness. We create it in an extraordinary state, and that extraordinary state is from a place of non-ego. In other words, without attachment to the outcome. And that is precisely what John is saying here. Ask without hidden motive. So, in other words, if we've got a big ego investment in showing somebody how powerful we are with our prayer, there's a chance it may not happen.
Well, that goes back to what we talked about last hour. Actually, it was Tony Campolo that talked about blasphemous prayers.
Sure.
Prayers that just, they're really about us, not about anything else. It's just about, look at me, you know, aren't I pious? I mean, any of that. And those aren't going to have an effect in a way, because it doesn't sound like they're tripping any dominoes. I mean, in this chain reaction, in this, you know, energy field reaction, there's nothing on which to act.
Well, precisely. And this goes back to our experience 1998. We were in Tibet for 22 days and visited 12 monasteries and two nunneries. Through the translators, we asked the same question, Ian, every time we had from the monks, the nuns, and the abbots. And they all answered us in relatively the same way, but it was one particular abbot whose answer was so clear. And I asked the same question. I said, when we see you chanting for 12 and 16 hours a day, and we see the mudras and the mantras and the bells and the bowls and the gongs and the chimes and the incense, we see your prayers on the outside. What are you doing on the inside? How are you creating those effects of healing, for example? And he looked at me and through the translator back, my Tibetan is really poor. What he said was, you've never seen our prayers. He said, because a prayer cannot be seen. He said, what you are seeing are the things we do to create the feeling in our bodies. He said the feeling is the prayer, very clearly. The feeling is the prayer. And then he turned the question on me. He said, how do you do it in your culture? And I thought back, when we lost those texts telling us the power of feeling, to be surrounded by our answer, we began to believe that the words of the prayers, if we say our words the right number of times, and maybe that's what this blasphemous prayer is all about, that somehow something magic is going to happen, when really the prayer isn't the words at all from this perspective. The prayer isn't the words. The words are just catalysts. They are codes designed to elicit a state of emotion within us, and it is the emotion that is interacting. It's the interface between human and divine. It's what's interacting with the field, and that's precisely what the experiments are showing now.
I think that's very interesting. And I am reminded, actually, of Plato. I mean, and that belief in the, how did he refer to it as, you know, like the perfect tree exists kind of in theory or in heaven, so to speak. And then we have the particular tree, the tree particular, which is whatever tree that we have in front of us, which will be a reflection of that perfection, but it can't ever be perfect in and of itself. But that we are always, we always look at one to glimpse the other, or that the other, the perfect, is always there with the particular at the same time. We just don't see it, I guess.
Oh, Ian, that's the introduction in your new book.
Yeah, that you'll be writing.
Well,
in the foreword.
Well, I wanted to just share some of these other perspectives, again, so they're not all Greg Bradenisms, but you can hear in the Gospels, if you're inclined to look to those texts for your answers, you can hear from contemporary mystics like Neville. You hear it from the scientists. If we can honor the wisdom of our past, because obviously there's a lot that has been known that we may not look at quite the same today.
Right.
If we can marry that with the best science of our time, what I believe we'll do is we'll create a wisdom collectively. We'll do this together. We'll create a wisdom that's greater than the science has led us to so far, or than the religion and the spirituality has been able to offer to us. We marry them together. And I'll tell you, and I'm sure your listeners will agree with this, Ian, all we have to do is look to the world around us today, and if there was ever a time where we could feel empowered, and if we are empowered, we could make a difference in our world, it seems like this is the time to do it.
I wonder what the Kabbalah might have to say about this, too.
Well, it's the same thing. It's actually the Kabbalistic text that led us to the God Code, and the, where this dovetails in. The God Code literally says that within the DNA of all life, of every human that has ever walked the earth or is here right now, it says that we are God within the body. It doesn't say we are God. It says that we have qualities or characteristics, God-like characteristics, and I believe that is what empowers us to use the emotion, our human-divine interface, to bring about the changes, to find a way to become greater than our differences, the differences that are splitting our world right down the middle right now, or the healing in our bodies. So many people and our loved ones, our pets, are being lost to forms of disease that never existed until we urbanized societies, like cancers. They're not something that's natural.
Who would have thought that Madonna would save us? That Madonna would... Well, I don't mean that Madonna, by the way, too. I mean the other Madonna. Very interesting. I'd love to see more on what the Kabbalah says about this, too. But we're not done yet. In fact, now this is just your chance to jump into the conversation, too. Right after we do the top of the hour news check, Greg, I want to come back and I want to pray peace.
Sure.
And I don't know quite how to do it without getting into words, and we'll have to keep it short in order not to fire off transmitter alarms all over the country when there's dead air. But let's see if we can figure out a way to do it.
I'll meet you right back here.
All right, Lost Mode of Prayer when we come back. Greg Braden next, Coast to Coast Live. My name's Ian Punnett. But by all means, join us in the conversation here with Greg Braden. Secrets of the Lost Mode of Prayer. And let's do an experiment here, as we have often done. But perhaps, as you pointed out, Greg, is this world feels like it's pulling apart a little bit at the seams these days, that we pray peace. Now, knowing that probably the one restriction we have is that most transmitter alarms are set at about 15 seconds, where if we're silent for 15 seconds or more, all sorts of things might happen for radio stations all along this network. I just, with that in mind, can you help guide us through what this might be like if we were to use this lost mode of prayer?
Absolutely, Ian, because this is the beauty of this mode of prayer. Rather than something that we do in a moment in time and then get up and end and go about the rest of our day, this is a feeling, and a feeling is something that we can have every moment of the day. We can have a feeling of what we'd like to have in our life, driving down the freeway, on our way to work, on our way to school, having dinner with our families. The prayer never has to end, and by virtue of this relationship between feeling and our world, life literally becomes the prayer. Life is the prayer. There's a precedent for what you're asking about tonight on a smaller scale. In 1988, during the Israeli-Lebanese war, a group of people were trained to feel the feeling of peace in their hearts, not think it, not say some peaceful words, but to feel the feeling of peace in their hearts. This is the lost mode of prayer. They were positioned throughout the Middle East in the war-torn areas during the war between Israel and Lebanon. And the results were documented. This is a scientific study done over a number of times over a period of time to make sure the effects weren't driven by holidays or lunar cycles or, you know, weather patterns or whatever. The results were published in the Journal of Conflict Resolution, Volume 32, Number 4, December 1988. It's called the International Peace Project in the Middle East. And the bottom line, you know, what they found was that during the time that people were feeling peace, terrorist activities dropped to zero. They stopped. Crimes against people declined. Emergency hospital room visits from accidents declined. Automobile accidents declined. And when the practitioners stopped what they were doing, all those statistics reversed. And when they would begin the prayer, what they called the prayer window again, then the statistics would drop again. And although they could not explain precisely why this effect was the way it was in 1988, the correlations were so high, they said there is certainly an effect. Now, the second part of this, Princeton University began a study in 1998 called the Global Consciousness Project, GCP, where they found that certain kinds of electronics respond to this kind of, to human consciousness, to changes in human consciousness. And they built 40 little devices, implanted them all over the earth, different continents, that all read back into one computer at Princeton University real time. It's happening right this minute. And when there is a change in global consciousness, it registers on the computer. Whether it's a good change or bad change, it was off the scale on 9/11, obviously, during the last episode of The Bachelor. The world wanted to see who The Bachelor was going to choose, and everybody was watching, and it registered on GCP.
I'll be darned.
The death of Princess Diana. And the reason I'm saying this now is because we have done experiments using the World Wide Web, where Princeton was able to pick up blips on their computer from what people on the Internet were doing all over the world, and all they were doing was feeling the feeling of peace.
All right, so let's just try this right here by just saying we're going to do it for, it'll just be a moment. It may be a blip in the show. But when we pray peace here, it doesn't mean pray for it. It doesn't mean petition for it. Not going to make a deal here with God. But to the divine, pray for the moment, the feeling of lack of conflict, where there's no conflict, whether that means, you know, conflict with somebody at work or in your family, or just try to let go any sense of conflict. Feel total peace. Feel the sound of what?
And this is the beauty. It can be anything, because
be anything.
The field is going to mirror back what we give it to work with. So where the practitioners felt the feeling as if the woman was healed, and my native friend felt all the feelings of what it's like when it rains, for each individual listening, just ask yourself, how would your life be different living in a world where peace has already happened, where you don't have a threat level blasting in your ear every time you walk through an airport, or hear about nuclear proliferation every time you turn on the evening news.
Okay, so here you go then.
And your kids are safe to go to school, and you feel safe leaving your doors open at night and walking down the street. What would that feel like? And then the key is to feel it in your heart rather than think it in your mind, and give appreciation and gratitude for that state.
And here we go.
Here we
in
go.
3, 2. Capture that, repeat it as often as you can. More with Greg Braden. Your calls next. Coast to Coast Live. This is Ian Punnett. Let's go with it. All of your calls waiting, and a couple open lines for you if you want to join in the conversation with Greg Braden. East of the Rockies, Richard is in Nassau County, New York, on Coast to Coast Live for Greg Braden. Richard?
Yeah, hello. Greg? Richard, it's good to hear you. It's good to hear you, Greg. I unfortunately just heard the last 15 minutes prior to the commercial. And
So you want me to sum up the last 2 hours and...
No. I think I'm pretty much on theme with you. As long as you're talking about Neville, who wrote Awakened Imagination, The Law of the Problem. Is that Neville?
Well, I use Neville's work, the Power of Awareness, The Law and the Promise, to give an example of a modern day, a contemporary example of how these principles have been left to us.
Okay, so what you're really talking about is not praying so much in an active sense, as the ego doing something. What you're talking about is impressing the subconscious with an ironclad belief that something already exists, and then it brings it about.
Earlier in the program, we described the discoveries in quantum physics of an intelligent field that permeates all of creation, and it responds to human emotion. And we're using these as examples of how to create that kind of emotion in our bodies, so that the quantum effects are felt beyond our bodies. We documented this in the Tibetan monasteries, 1998, 2001, and 2005.
Don't have to convince me. I've seen this work. It really does work. But my question is this: how do you? I'm really sorry I missed the beginning of the program, Greg. But how do you impress a belief in positivity within, you know, my mind's like most people's, you know, has more faith in fear than it does in faith.
Sure.
And how do you, because, you know, it, like Christ said, you know, if you say to the mountain move, if you see the mountain move, you can make it move.
Sure.
But if there is the tiniest little infinitesimal molecule of doubt, the whole thing falls apart like a house of cards.
Precisely.
And the trick is to make that thing ironclad, that belief.
Right.
Do you have any tips or any suggestions as to how one could do that?
Well, this is where the power, the question you're asking essentially is if you feel like you're lying to yourself. If you're in the presence of a loved one and you're saying, my loved one is healed, while you're standing next to them in the intensive care unit and the nurse is saying, you know, something very different is happening, how do you go about doing that? And there is no answer to that. That is right, wrong, good, or bad. This is where quantum physics is marrying spirituality to give us a new way of looking at our world. And what quantum physics says is that our universe, our world, our everyday lives are nothing more and nothing less than probabilities and possibilities until we grab one of those possibilities and lock into it with our consciousness and our belief. And what that says to us is that everything we can imagine is already happening as a possibility. It is our belief or our faith or the knowing that it has already happened that gives the quantum nudge to bring that into our reality. So if we buy into the fact that there is only one reality, that that there must be a global war, or that our loved one must have the condition that they're showing to us, then this kind of prayer is probably going to be hard. It'll put us through our paces. It'll test us. If we can find a place within ourselves to allow for many possibilities and say, okay, this is only one possibility, and feel the feeling of what it would be like if another possibility crystallizes in our presence, that's the subtle but the powerful difference between buying into the illusion of what the world's showing us and going with it and saying that what the world's showing us is only one possibility, and that there are other possibilities.
All right, that'll do it. Thank you. And it's a very good question. Just for the record, Sam, you're breaking a promise. But I think your answer there was an interesting tie-in to Morpheus, and I can only assume that's his real name. First time caller line in Watson, California. Morpheus? Are you Morpheus?
I am Morpheus, but I'm not he.
Well, that's fine. Now, is that Morpheus is your real name?
It is, yes.
Is that really? How wonderful.
Yes.
Which became increasingly cooler after The Matrix came out then, didn't it?
Well, certainly more commented on.
Yes, more complicated anyway.
Morpheus, welcome to the show tonight. It's good to hear your voice.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You have a question or a comment?
Yeah, I had a comment on something that Greg said about how this technique of prayer is still practiced in many traditional cultures.
Yes.
And I am a member of a pagan witchcraft tradition, and I noticed that the technique of prayer that you mentioned is basically the same thing as something that we know as sorcery, which is the use of the imagination to conjure a strong sensation of emotion, the presence of the thing that you are trying to create. So this is actually a technique that is used within Western magical traditions, and it strikes me that that it's not so much that it's a lost technique of prayer. Maybe it's more that our society has been lost from it for a long time, basically since the point in history at which we departed from the magical worldview.
Well, the reason you've mentioned a couple of things here. There are many different names to identify how this mode works, and all the imagination is important, and it is a powerful component. What separates this modality from many of the other traditions is our love for what we are imagining, or the emotion of love, or the feeling of love, is what brings that dream or that wish or that imaginative state into the reality. So where many traditions simply dream or wish or hope, and I'm not suggesting yours is one of those, but I'm making this distinction, it's the power of human emotion, and this is the power that links us to the divine in the ancient traditions. The reason I say it was lost to the West, it almost became a joke, because it's like as soon as we left Western cultures, no matter where we went, it's a given. These other cultures, they assume that we already know this. They're amazed that we would travel halfway across the world for 22 days in the 17,000 feet above sea level into a monastery to find out about something. They think that everybody already knows.
Yeah, and I have to say, I've known a few Wicca over the years, Morpheus, and when I was reading Greg's description of how he first experienced this, and then even what we were just doing a few minutes ago, that doesn't chime with me with how I've seen, the practice of earth-based traditions, personally, anyway. I mean, I haven't seen that done like this.
Yeah, well, one thing is that there are a number of different pagan traditions, and
sure,
Wicca is one of them, but there are
right.
others that focus more on this type of what I've known as sorcery.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. I always find sorcery to be much more verbal, and sorcery, it's at least in my experiences with it, really is focused on using words to conjure.
You know, I think that to a certain extent the terms get used differently in different groups of people.
Okay.
So it sounds to me like what I know as sorcery isn't referring to the thing that you know as sorcery.
Right. No, I totally get that. And I know it's the panoply of Wiccanism is so much bigger than all of that. So
it's also in constant change.
Right.
But I wanted to comment on the irony that I was hearing. Greg, you were mentioning that the practitioners you worked with thought it was strange that you would travel so far to find this technique far from your home area, and I find that really ironic too, because it seems to me like it basically was there all along, even within the Western tradition, but it's just a sort of rejected and denied component of the Western tradition, the inner magical traditions that for the last several hundred years since people became very focused on scientism, or sort of science as a faith, and materialism, all those things, those magical aspects of the people's worldview were kind of repressed and rejected, and but they've been there all along.
They've been there in pockets, and again, we go back, we had this as part of our culture up until about 1700 years ago in the 4th century, when it was edited out of the text that so many people in the West relied upon for this kind of information. It's not about religion, but they relied upon the biblical text as both historic as well as spiritual understandings of how we relate to the world. And when those were lost, we became and we evolved into a technological and a scientifically based society. And what's happened now is that science and technology, we pushed it about as far as we can push it without coming back full circle to understand how to apply what science is showing us. So scientists say, yeah, the field's out there. What do we do with it? How do we use this thing?
Right.
So this is the marriage of these two things together. It was in these other traditions, however, where it was broadly used, widely accepted, well documented, so that I could bring that back and share it with people in our part of the world and say, you know, this is what we found, and it's another tool to put into your toolbox of how you live your life.
Well, I think we have time if we hustle for the wild card line, Sean from Mississippi, and if Ron in Hawaii can hang on, we'll get to him coming up right away. But Sean?
Yes, Mr. Ian and Greg.
Hey, Sean, it's good to hear your voice.
Thank you very much. There are so many things that I could say that would draw everything into a picture that many could see. And I know that at this very moment and in this time that it was meant to be to talk to both of you. And I'll tell you what, it's a lonely existence to know and realize the transformation that takes place. And I'll tell you that it's a very emotional situation, because I don't watch television, use computers, or do anything. So basically I'm in myself realizing different things that seem to have been long lost.
Well, I appreciate you then making that connection with us here and now, all the way from Mississippi. And so there you go.
Thank you for the work that you're doing. We appreciate
it. From New York to California to Mississippi, and then shortly out to Hawaii, and we'll just keep going across North America and beyond, because it's Saturday night and this is Coast to Coast Live. Well, and Greg Braden has been taking us into some very different places, I think, than most people usually go when they're talking about technology and prayer, and that's what this new book is all about. It's recovering, perhaps not discovering, but recovering an ancient and, by and large, lost art, a lost mode of prayer. Ron is in Hawaii, west of the Rockies, on Coast to Coast Live for Greg Braden. Ron?
Hi,
thanks for having me.
Good evening, Ron.
How are you this evening?
I'm well, and yourself?
Oh, good. Wasn't it Jesus who said you are forgiven before you even ask? It's like you think it, and it's been done. Sort of ties in with the timeless, instantaneous.
Yeah, I like that.
Well, precisely, and it's an area that we haven't even gotten into tonight. We probably won't in this this conversation. But the field that we're talking about is a holographic field, and it's the reason that information between the donor and his DNA was transmitted simultaneously, because it never had to travel from point A to point B. It was already there. It suggests that when we share our prayers, that we don't have to send them from our living room to our loved ones in Iraq or halfway around the world and expend the energy to do that. Our prayers are already there. The forgiveness is already there. The peace is already there. So it opens the door even further to a vast array of possibilities in terms of who we are and how we really function in this universe of ours. How much power do we really have to change what's going on in our world?
And it broadens the use of the word communion in that sense, that it's something commingling. It's going on simultaneously.
You know, Ian, what's so interesting, it does. And what's so interesting is that the word prayer itself is a word that at least I have never seen in any of the ancient scrolls or documents, manuscripts that we're talking about. You don't see it in the Dead Sea Scrolls. You don't see it in the other the traditions that we're talking about. You see, it appears to be a relatively recent word. The word that they use is actually the word commune or communion, which has it's a subtle, but it's a very, very powerful distinction between prayer, something that we do, and communion,
right,
something that we're sharing with this this field around us.
Well, that gets two reactions for me. One is similar to that. The word atonement, as I was always raised to break that word up into the syllables of at-one-ment.
Precisely.
And just to be at one is to atone. It's just to be whole in that. And then, you know, in the, and I don't, sometimes people get a little wiggy if I get too Christian on them, but I've always loved that thing about communion in Christianity, that the idea of communion is that you are in the present tense with everybody who has ever been before you, is now, and ever will be. And the communion is not just with the people that are there, but everybody who has ever been and ever will be in all space and time.
Past, present, and future. That's why my native friend, when he stepped into the circle, he literally said the words, all of my ancestors. He was honoring their presence. And the beauty, I'd just like to clarify this before we take our next caller, the beauty of this internal technology, this mode of prayer, is that it was around long before any religions came along. They came afterward and were built around the understandings that pre-existed, that allow us to participate. And I'm going to use that word real consciously. I'm not going to say control or manipulate, but they allow us to participate in the healing of our bodies and the peace of our world and the joy in our families, because from this perspective, we truly are part of everything that we see.
We'll commune with more. Jump in. There's one or two open lines, but they're filling up fast for Greg Braden on Coast to Coast Live. This is Ian Punnett. I've been making notes as we're going along on this, Greg, and I think we've actually hit most of the topics we said we would later digress and go back to. But if you can think of any that you remember that you want to talk about, we'll make sure that we'll have a little more time for that coming up. After we get to Mike and Luke and Jacqueline, first east of the Rockies, where Mike is in St. Louis on Coast to Coast Live for Greg Braden. Mike?
Hi. Yeah, it's great to hear your subject tonight. I just wanted to ask a question about if Greg has investigated Christian Science, because it's Mary Baker Eddy who wrote Science and Health in the 1800s, you know, pretty much covers everything you've been talking about as far as spirit and God being mind, and because God is mind and God is all, then there is no matter.
Yeah, I've heard an echo of that in this conversation, too. Greg, what's your experience?
Sure. Christian Science, the Church of Religious Science, a lot of traditions touch on this in general. What makes those what makes this tradition stand apart, and what we want to emphasize in this tradition, is it is not a mental, and the science has shown, it's not a mental exercise when we use this mode of prayer. It has got to be based in heart-based, heart-centered, coherent feelings of emotion, particularly love, the love and appreciation and gratitude for the peace in our world and for the healing in our bodies. So while many of these other traditions, and by the way, where these traditions come from, many of them, as different as they appear, when you follow them back far enough, they all tie into this lineage of wisdom. There was a knowledge that links our modern world with our past.
Right.
And the difference is, and the powerful yet subtle difference, is that this invites us to feel the feeling as if it's already happened, as if our prayer has already been answered, and to live our lives. Life literally becomes the prayer. So the prayer never ends, and that is a very, very powerful distinction in terms of how these traditions are offered.
Right, prayer without ceasing, as it was called. Yeah, I think if you go back to Meister Eckhart and Jacob Burma and a bunch of these the mystics, I think you'll find a pretty similar thread.
Sure.
All right, let's go to Luke, wildcard line. He's in Nebraska, and he's on Coast to Coast Live for Greg Braden. Go ahead, Luke.
Yeah, what a great program you're having.
Good evening, Luke. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, again, your program just literally saved my life years ago, and Coast to Coast. But
we're glad to have you.
Yeah, just a couple things I was going to mention. Have you heard of or read of Black Elk Speaks by John Neihardt?
Oh, sure, sure.
Yeah, anyway, that's a powerful book, but one phrase by Neihardt was, science will one day prove what the mystic already knows. And I think that's exactly what you're talking about tonight. And,
precisely. They're both languages. They're both different ways of describing our relationship to the universe.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, another point I'm just going to bring up that, for, I guess, clarification or feedback, it seems like, you know, nowadays we need rain.
Sure.
And
some parts of the country do, some don't.
Yeah, I guess that's right. And in the Midwest and stuff. But,
yeah.
You know, it seems like years ago we used to pray for rain. We used to be more of an ag society, desire and want and need rain. And therefore we seem to have gotten rain. And now it seems like we need to... I guess I'm sensing we don't want rain.
Well,
so we're not getting rain in a way.
Well, you can also say we need peace.
Yeah.
But look, but if we go about praying for these things the way that we have been led to believe it works, the condition, if you pray for something, I mean, just ask yourself, if you're praying for something to happen, what you're saying is in that moment, it's not there. We've seen millions, perhaps billions of people praying for peace, and people believe that the situation in the world has gotten worse. So we know what happens when we pray for something. Let's try something different. Let's pray peace and see what happens. Let's pray rain and see what happens. And by the way, in northern New Mexico, they've done that. In the pueblos between Albuquerque and Taos, they have done that because we are also in a drought condition, and there's now snow in the mountains. So, you know, scientifically, you can't prove it. But the correlations are so high. Of course, the native peoples have always known there's an effect.
Jacqueline in Missoula on the first-time caller line for Greg Braden. Jacqueline?
Hi.
Good evening, Jacqueline.
Good evening. It's a great show tonight.
Thank you.
I have a question about doing this as often as you can. I believe that's a comment that you said earlier, Ian. And
right.
My question is, if you don't really have the faith or the belief system to have a really strong, you know, feeling of this love and gratitude because you've got doubt in your belief system,
right,
then it's, you know, it seems you got two ways to go, to continue to do it to strengthen that, or on the other hand, by continuing, it seems to negate that what you've already done. You don't believe it's going to work.
You're taking the the road that some people describe as sort of fake it till you feel it, kind of that. What are the ways of looking at that? Jacqueline, don't go anywhere, because Greg, I think you're going to have something to add to that. She's saying she doesn't know if she can keep going with it until she sees evidence of it, and she can't see evidence of it until she can start to feel it. And so maybe there's a catch-22 in there.
Yeah.
Well, the feeling is the key. And again, it's not something that it's not a mental process. We must feel that it's so. What the studies have shown, and we didn't even get to this in the program tonight, but the scientific studies show how many people it takes to have these kinds of feelings before the effect is felt in their world. When the studies were done in the Middle East, the International Peace Project in the Middle East, the number is the square root of 1% of a given population. So whether you're talking about a room full of people or a city or a nation or a planet, you take that number of people, you take 1% of that number, and then you punch in the little square root function in your calculator, and the numbers are relatively small. And if you can work with other people, when the practitioner that we talked about earlier, those three practitioners were healing the woman's cancer, I asked the gentleman who was there, who actually did the filming, I said, why were there three practitioners? Could this woman have done it by herself? Did there have to be three? And he said, it was very interesting, he said, in all probability, she could have done it by herself, and in all probability, Jacqueline, you can do this alone. But what makes this interesting is that we seem to do better when we're supported by others who have a similar belief. It doesn't take a lot of others. So if you can find one or two other people who can share this belief, and you'll find little anecdotal miracles in your life, and you'll say, well, maybe that's just a coincidence. And when you see them often enough, you begin to accept that there is an effect that's happening.
Let's go. Thank you so much, Jacqueline. I hope that helps. And maybe, you know, one or two days of trying it and making it a habit won't make you so aware of the fact that you're doing it. And just take those moments and just try to pray that peace, or pray whatever it is that you're thinking about, until you really feel that in your heart. Don't try to argue its truth or non-truth. Just try to feel its truth. West of the Rockies, Ross is in 29 Palms for Greg Braden. Ross?
Yes, sir. How you doing?
Good.
Good evening, Ross.
Good evening.
I know you're part of the world very well. It's good to hear from you.
Sir, I'd like to tell you that you guys are liars.
Ah.
Did you know that the Bible says, ye err not knowing the scriptures, nor the power of God? You guys are so far off base.
Hey, so let me ask you this, Ross. Where would you see a conflict between what you just said and what we're saying tonight?
Okay. You quoted from a guy that said that the Bible is unedited in the Aramaic text, right?
No.
Yeah, you said that the Bible...
No.
Is the edited version, and that in the 4th century, it was in the original Aramaic.
No, he didn't say that. He didn't say that. And what he's saying is, and actually biblical scholars believe that the original texts for all of, say, the New Testament texts were all originally written in Aramaic. Now they
wrong, because
original
scriptures were written in Greek.
No, listen.
That tells me that you have no idea what you're talking about.
You know what? I think, first of all, you got to pull that hostility out.
I'm not hostile.
If you start with the thing about liars, and then you start with the constant interruptions, it sounds very hostile. It's hard to get a feeling from you that you have some sort of greater peace or understanding if you come out swinging and keep swinging, because nobody's swinging back at you. And I will tell you what I know from seminary, and that's 3 years of some pretty expensive education, that what we don't know about the scriptures could fill a library. What we do know, we're proud of, and we do know that the earliest known physical texts of the Christian scriptures are in Greek. But there appears to be references, and the Gospel of Thomas is another good example of that, where the originals were originally written down in Aramaic. It makes a lot more sense for them to have been passed along in Aramaic. It was the common language of the time. That's why the Passion of the Christ was done in Aramaic. It was the spoken common language. Greek was the more formal written language, and that makes more sense, too, that at some point it gets codified into the Greek that we have today. So I hope that's helpful for you. But it isn't a matter of somebody lying. It's a matter of perhaps you not having as much information as you think you have and making a presumption from there that somebody's out to hurt you by giving information that's in conflict with what you think you already know. And I don't think that that stands as a testament in a witness to your faith like you think it does. Final call, international line, Mina is in Montreal. Mina?
Hello.
Hi, you get one quick minute here with Greg Braden.
Good evening, Mina.
Hello, Greg. I am very impressed and grateful for your work.
Thank you.
The tape from Nightingale Conant.
Yes.
With the last language of God, speaking the last language of God.
Yes.
And that really helped me because I have been having experiences, I would say, from I was a child. And many people think, well, I am crazy, but I know I'm not.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I just want to say my opinion here about what this World Wide Web is from my experience. I think it is love.
The World Wide Web is love?
Is love. Mm. Love. Because if we stop and think, for me, it says, we live and move and have our being in this thing.
Hmm.
Now,
well,
pardon?
No, that's good. We just got to be quick here. That's an interesting thought.
I'm going to try. And God is love.
Well, precisely. Precisely. And
we have the commandment that we should love love God with all our heart, all our soul, and love our neighbors as ourselves.
Well, that's good enough, and I appreciate that comment.
That's the essence of the lost mode of prayer.
Okay. Although I would think that in the lost mode of prayer, there are probably fewer pop-ups for Viagra.
Well, you know, in the native traditions, the world around us is a mirror of the way we work within, because we're trying to remember who we really are. So when we look at the way the web functions, it's a beautiful metaphor for the way we're all connected, and in that way it is.
Well, you can certainly connect up to Greg Braden through coasttocoastam.com. Greg, enjoyed our conversation. Look forward to future conversations with you and anytime, any place, anywhere.
Ian, I want to thank you for being such a gracious host and for your enthusiasm and your wisdom in everything we've talked about as well.
Well,
and all the listeners for tuning in tonight. So,
yeah,
so thank you.
It was quite a night. And I look forward to one of these days I'll finish the book I'm working on, and I look forward to you writing a foreword for it. So thank you so much.
We've got witnesses, I promise.
Okay. The contract's been signed in front of witnesses. Thank you so much. And Art Bell coming up next. The Night of Science continues in a slightly different direction, but I think just as enjoyable. In the meantime, Deus te amat, and I do too.